welcome to the Two Sets Tennis Podcast, a podcast from the perspective of two Canadian superfans who love tennis and want to talk about it. Hi, I'm Rami.
And I'm Sue.
Sue, how are you? It's been a while.
It's been a very long time. Yes.
Life has happened.
Yes, life but has we're happened. Here. And now we're back.
And now we're back, and we are hoping to be back in a more regular manner to talk about tennis this year. So,
absolutely.
Great.
So where do you want to start?
Well, I think we should take our mind back to a couple of months ago when it was cold and snowy in Toronto, and the only thing that kept us sane was watching the Australian Open.
Yes.
Which I thought was a great tournament this year.
Oh, it was fantastic. Yeah, it was. You know what? It was so long ago that I can hardly remember. All I remember is the feeling that it was an amazing tournament.
Yeah, because I knew we were going to talk about it today, and I was trying to sort of set my mind back to what excited me about that tournament. And I guess there was a few stories, and the ones that jumped out at me are obviously, you know, the winners, Djokovic and Osaka.
Yeah.
And I think the two stories that I loved this year were the emergence of Stefanos Tsitsipas, his coming of age,
yes,
the majors, and also the Petra Kvitova story. So I don't know which we want to talk about or anything that sort of jumped out at you or that you remember that you love from that tournament.
Well, I mean, I'm, as you know, I'm a huge Naomi Osaka fan. So that story jumped out at me because, you know, it was literally her second Grand Slam in what, less than a year? Actually, no, she won Indian Wells last year, and then she proceeded to win, within a span of what, 6 months or so? US Open.
Well, I mean, go on.
Sorry, no, like, yeah, she's like sort of this, the first out of sort of the young new players on the WTA side to sort of win two Grand Slams in a row, which is pretty amazing.
Yeah.
For someone who...
Well, it hasn't happened since, I think the last time it happened where someone backed up their first slam with...
Oh, with Jennifer Capriati, right? Yeah.
Which is 2001. Yeah. So
it's been a while. So she, you know, had an amazing run, and I was so pleased to see her win. So congrats to Naomi. It's you know, a little late in coming, but but she's quite the superstar.
Well, I think she really announced herself as a superstar, the thing that made me the happiest for her was the fact that she, and I think I said this at the end of the US Open, that was my biggest wish, was for her to get to the next slam final and win it, because the way she won the US Open, she was robbed of that moment. And you know, she kind of solidified herself as a slam champion. I don't think there was an asterisk next to the match at the US Open, but there's always that thing of, did the umpire interfere? Did this happen? You know, and some people think like that.
Right.
But the fact that she came back and won the next slam, not necessarily playing her best getting to the final, I have to say, because I actually thought the way she got to that final and the way Kvitova got to the final, I was convinced Kvitova was going to win it.
Yes.
Because she was, I think Kvitova up to the final was playing the better tennis, to be honest with
you. Yeah, I do remember messaging with you on the semifinal night that when Kvitova won. And I think we were both saying, oh my gosh, if Kvitova continues to play like this, like, she could very well come out with the winner.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because she destroyed Danielle Collins, wasn't it? And it was like,
yeah.
I was like, well, if she keeps going like this. Yeah.
It was just like she just found her form in that semifinal. I was just watching her and I thought, oh my goodness, this, she's unstoppable right now, you know? And I don't think, you know, her opponent knew what to do. I think that her opponent was just kind of hanging on and Kvitova was just sort of cruising to the end, yeah, which was amazing to see considering she'd been through so much just the year prior, right? With the break into her home and the injury to her hand, her playing hand, actually.
Yes.
And, you know, and the trauma that she's had to deal with as a result of that incident, it was tremendously inspiring, absolutely inspiring. So the final was something that I think both of us were really, really looking forward to watching. And it didn't disappoint, did it?
No, it didn't disappoint. And I have to say, I'm a big Kvitova fan. And it was one of those situations where I would have been very happy with either player winning mm-hmm. that final, because I love them both. And I don't think I've gone into a match or like a Grand Slam final in a while where I was equally rooting for each player.
I agree.
You know, I mean, I think I slightly was rooting a bit more for Osaka, just a little bit. But it wasn't like, you know, like when I watch Federer and Nadal, for example, mm-hmm. As much as I like Nadal, I'm always rooting for Roger mm-hmm. to win that match.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
So, and with in the case of this, it was definitely me sort of wanting both of them to play their best. And I think they did. I think Kvitova didn't play her best in that first set, but then she came back yeah. and in the second and everything. So, yeah, it was exciting to watch. Mm. It was a really, really good match to watch. And I was happy that it went three sets. Yeah. And I was happy with the happiness of Osaka at the end, because, you know, I would not have liked for her to not have that sort of moment of lifting the trophy without all the controversy and people booing her and, you know, all that ridiculous stuff that happened at the US Open. So,
yeah. Yeah, I feel the same way. I was definitely rooting for both of them. And it turned out to be one of the most really sort of really, really competitive matches, which is what you want in a final, right? You want the final match to be really competitive in a Grand Slam, and they both delivered, and I was just happy for both of them, to be quite honest, because I think Petra Kvitova, she, I think, really understood the significance of the moment, of the fact of, you know, of being able to recover, and she finds herself at the final of a Grand Slam, you know, and that was a really poignant moment for her. And then, of course, Naomi.
Do you think that affected her? Do you think that affected her play a little bit? It might have, like, added an extra layer of nerves, or like an extra layer of, you know, Martina Navratilova always said when she always played better when she was younger, she felt less stress. And because the moment didn't mean less, but she didn't grasp the hugeness of it until later in life. And maybe in a similar way, Kvitova, because she had this experience and she thought she won't play again, maybe the significance of her winning a final, like a large final like that, maybe overwhelmed her a little bit at the beginning of that match. Because she was a bit tentative as well.
Yeah, I mean, without a doubt. I mean, I'm sure she was fighting a lot of her own, you know, sort of demons in that first set, right? You know, probably trying to grapple with her own confidence level, you know, and maybe, you know, having to learn how to trust herself and her wrist, you know, and her injured wrist and hand, and you know, and sort of kind of fight her way through that. So, you know, certainly that that could be an explanation as to why the first set went the way that it did. But she certainly found herself in the second. And I think her confidence sort of like just went through the roof, and she started to play like the old Kvitova, you know, that we're used to seeing. So yeah, that was really, really wonderful to see. So
I actually wanted to talk about something else that's sort of related to this. I think the most shocking story for me this last couple of months in tennis is Osaka and her coach, Sasha Bajin, or Payen, I don't know how you say his last name, splitting after such success. It really shocked me. I'm still surprised by it. Like, why tinker with something that was working so well? I just don't understand what's happening
there. I was completely shocked when I heard that. You were the one who actually sent me the article that you first saw it in, and I just stopped in my tracks. I think I was maybe walking to the bus stop, and I literally stopped and was like, what the hell? What is this? And, you know, and I thought, no, this is one of those sort of like fake news stories.
Well, that's when you know we're like super fans, because we're like, oh my God, Osaka fired her coach. Yeah. What? Yeah. And we're like, we're stopping in our tracks. Yeah. And it's like, I don't know, what's the big deal?
Yeah. And me thinking this is fake news. Oh my God. And then, you know, it was literally The Guardian, you know, reporting on it. And I was like, oh, damn it. It's not fake. It's for real.
Who would plant that story as a fake story?
but that's how shocking clamoring it was to me. So
it was a shock.
Yeah.
It was definitely a shock.
Yeah, it was so shocking. And I still don't know why it happened. Like I really don't. She hasn't said very much about it, other than the fact that it wasn't about money, which is, you know, sadly partly why, you know, what we had sort of speculated a little bit.
I think maybe she said it wasn't about money, but I think I'm just trying to think, what else could it be? Mm-hmm. Like, she has all the success. Maybe he was asking for more money, or I don't know. It just seems to me, but you never know what's happening behind the scenes, right? Like, you never know.
Like, she did.
Maybe they just weren't getting along or whatever.
I think she did allude to the fact that maybe their relationship had kind of broken down during just before the Australian Open. I mean, there was a bit of, you know, she did imply that a little bit. But I think this is one of those things that, you know, we'll never know.
No, they won't talk about it, will they?
Yeah. And we'll just, you know, and I guess it falls in line with, you know, sort of the coaching carousel, right? That they talk about in both the WTA and the ATP, you know, how just coaches kind of, you know, go from player to player to player. Especially on the women's side, it seems there's a lot of sort of coach switching and dropping and,
It happens quite a lot.
Yeah. It happens quite a lot on the women's side, I feel. So, you know, maybe this is just one of those things. And, you know, I really do hope that Sasha finds, you know, another gig, you know, because I really do hope that, you know, another player picks him up because I think at the end of the day, he is a good coach, you know. He was able to, you know, get results out of Naomi in less than a year. So that's, you know, a pretty good resume.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if it's, I don't know, maybe because of the timing that it happened, because everyone else has already coached up, you know, by the Australian. Maybe he'll find someone. I don't know. Maybe, you know, Simona Halep is coachless, isn't she?
Yeah.
Maybe she can take him on, or somebody. I don't
know. Well, I have a bit of, I do follow him on Instagram.
Of course I do.
He actually posted a Insta story where he showed it looked like airplane tickets going to Miami. So I do believe he's either there as a spectator or he's there in some other capacity.
Well, you know who needs a shakeup maybe in her coaching team is, dare I say, Serena Williams.
Are you? Whoa.
Well, you know, maybe. Well, she's not had the best time since she's come back, I have to say, for Serena. And, you know, that match against Pliskova at the Australian, where she had those 6 match points and she rolled her ankle. And I don't know, maybe she needs to shake things up. And, you know, he was her hitting partner for so long.
You know what? Yeah, I never even thought of that as a possibility, but it's certainly a possibility, isn't it?
Yeah, Serena, if you're listening to us.
But I would feel like Sasha would want to go back as a coach and not as a hitting partner, right?
Well, that's what I mean. Maybe her, because her and Patrick Mouratoglou, they don't seem to be as in sync these days as they were before. Mm-hmm. So that's why I'm saying maybe, you know, because Patrick Mouratoglou always seems to be more interested in the limelight and the camera.
I feel like Patrick wants to transition his career.
Yeah. And also, like, he's busy with, like, upcoming Stefanos Tsitsipas. So I don't know if he's devoting all his time with Serena. Yeah.
But do you really think...
So maybe she
needs... But do you really think at this point in Serena's career she really does need a coach?
Federer has a coach. Everyone, I think all the great ones have somebody. Mm-hmm. You know, this is what I mean. She needs to, I think she herself will want to, you know, I know she's had a bit of bad luck and everything. Mm-hmm. And I know it's hard to come back after giving birth. Like, I'm not discrediting that or sort of minimizing it. But it just seems like her comeback, for her, probably more than anyone else, is disappointing. I'm sure she's very disappointed in it, you know. And I think she was injured at Indian Wells, all this other stuff. So, or maybe she just needs a better physio. I don't know, or you know, but something needs to sort of
get her pick back up on with track. Her. Yeah, I guess.
I mean, I still think she's going to win Wimbledon this year, but who knows?
Yeah, I guess according to Serena, like if we're looking at through Serena's perspective, she probably is feeling like her comeback is a little less than what she'd hoped for. So maybe this might be a good move because Sasha is someone familiar, someone she knows, someone she trusts, right? But now he's got, you know, a lot of intel, let's say, on the number one player, right? On the number one player.
Maybe that was Sasha's plan all along. Get Osaka to number one.
Maybe.
And then move back.
Yes. It's all very much in the plan. And then go back to Serena's camp.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. There you go.
I don't know, but you know what? You raise an interesting scenario, and it'll be we'll have to see. We'll have to see once play starts at the Miami Open.
Well, if it happens, all I'm saying is I think Serena's been listening to the podcast.
We called it first.
We called it first, so Serena, retweet us, please.
Yes, please. And I'll definitely have to be scanning the seats for Sasha's face, and we'll have to see. To see where he shows up. Oh, my gosh.
I want to also talk about the men's tournament. Did you watch the men's final at all, or did you not?
I think I may have fallen asleep.
I think because you probably woke up and it was over,
that's
right?
Probably
because,
what happened.
Because we were expecting this like 6 hour epic match.
Yes.
And it was over like in an hour and a half. It was crazy. It was like, I don't think I've ever seen Djokovic play as well as he did and just completely destroy one of the big four, or big three, or whatever you want to call them.
Yeah.
In that manner. I don't think I've ever seen that in a Grand Slam final ever. And I felt so bad for Nadal in that final. It was just a demolition job. Yeah. That's the only way you can sort of call it. And yeah, I was shocked by that result. Like, I thought Djokovic would win, but just the manner in which he's so completely broke down Nadal's game and just would not let him into the match was something to behold. Yeah. I think it was his greatest performance.
Yeah.
I really do. Yeah.
I don't remember what Nadal said about the match. Was Nadal just his usual uber sportsmanlike self and just said he was the better player? And
I mean, Nadal seems to be like that with everyone except for Kyrgios, but I mean, let's not.
Only because Kyrgios under
him.
He was
not happy about that loss against Kyrgios. Oh my God.
Yeah, I think that was sort of the solidification of Djokovic's, you know, no, there was no question at that point that Djokovic was back. You know?
Yes. Well, I mean, winning Wimbledon and the US Open, and then I think that solidified it.
Yeah. But yeah, but it also begs the question of, like, you know, what happened to Nadal, right? Like, what the hell happened? Was it, I mean, I didn't watch a lot of the match, but, like, you know, what did happen to Nadal out there?
I feel like Nadal, obviously, you know, he's lost a step. He definitely has lost a step. And to me, it's amazing that he's still where he is in the game. Given his physical style, like, that to me is incredible that he's still, I think, world number two.
Yeah.
At this point in his career, I actually thought a couple of years ago, we won't see him on a tennis court again, you know, and he's proved us wrong. And he's an incredible fighter and incredible athlete. I think his fighting spirit and his champion mentality has pushed him through so many matches that any other player would lose.
Yeah.
And I think that is something that is, out of every player of the modern era, I think he is the most champion-like in that regard.
Yeah, he's a true warrior for sure.
True warrior. Yeah. It's so, like, I have, you know, I always say I prefer Federer or whatever, but I can't not like Nadal, or I can't have like this amazing respect for him and this amazing sort of love for what he's done for the sport, because he's incredible. He, like, I mean, there's no other words to describe him. You know? But his style, not necessarily the style I like to watch sometimes, his playing style always, but he's an incredible champion, of course, you know, so. And actually, this kind of segues into a bit about, like, also, you know, we've written Federer off, and he gets his 100th title in Dubai, and he gets to the Indian Wells final. So, you know.
No, it's amazing.
Don't write off Federer either.
You know? I mean, the man is, what, 38 this year?
38, yes.
And he's still at the top of his game. I mean, he's not number one anymore, but he's still one of the three players that have won all of the Grand Slams last year, you know?
Yes.
And I mean, it's unbelievable. It's unbelievable that these top three players have continued to win well into their 30s, right? Federer's 38. Yeah. Nadal is
33, 34. 33, 34. And then I think
Djokovic, he's the youngest of the bunch, right?
33.
Yeah.
Yeah. And if you look at someone like, also, that's a story for, like, it's a story that we kind of forget now because it was at the beginning, but compare that to their other contemporary that people always, they lump him with them, because he got to a lot of the finals and lost. But, you know, look at Andy Murray. Mm-hmm. He couldn't get, he could, he, as great as Murray's career has been, obviously he hasn't had as good of a career as the other three, but you know, very good Hall of Fame career. But he was limping and he's had hip issues, and so that to me showed me how much the Djokovic, Nadal, Federer longevity, how more amazing it is when you think about it. When people like Murray, like Wawrinka, some of the people who are like in their generation sort of would shine for a while, but they wouldn't be able to sustain it, you know, and for physical reasons, for whatever other reasons. So that to me is also just like how amazing those three are. And I think we're living in this amazing era of tennis that we'll never see again.
Yeah, I think you're right. This was that cohort is truly special. And we're seeing the tail end of it, right? I mean, we were talking about how Federer announced that, you know, he's actually going to play the French Open this year. And you know, I immediately said to you, I was like, we have to get to the French Open to see him, because this may be the last time that Federer is going to be on clay at the French Open, you know? And so now we're talking like that. We're talking about, like, you know, this could be the last Wimbledon that Federer plays. This could be the last US Open that he plays, you know, could be the last Australian. Like, you know, it's hard to believe that it could be a possibility, but it's also a tremendous accomplishment that this man is still out there and he's killing it even against the young guns that are coming up, you know?
And he is an event. Like, I have to say, like, I've been lucky enough. I think I've seen him play 4 or 5 times in my lifetime. And every time I go and see him, especially the later years, I think the first time I saw him, like, he was just coming up, you know. But it's always an event. Everyone is excited. It's always, there's an energy in the stadium. There's an energy to everyone play. Like, everyone watching him is excited. The other players are excited. You know, I saw him play team at the ATP World Finals, and it wasn't like the greatest match I've ever seen, but the crowd was insane. Like, I've never seen a crowd get that excited about, what do you call it? Those round robin matches in my life. But they were like really into it. I think because also he lost his first match in that round robin, and people wanted him to get to the, you know, to win so he can move on further in the tournament. So people were just like at every, like, they were like cheering all the team errors. And I'm like, he destroyed team in that match. It was like 6-4, 6-2 or something. And people were still cheering the errors and everything. Oh, it was just insane. Like, I was like, poor guy. Like, his opponent must hate playing because they know the crowd is against them all the time. Like,
Federer fans are definitely something else, you know? Whenever we're at a tennis tournament together, we're always sort of like, oh gosh, here comes the Federer fans, of which we are, you know?
I'm a big fan too, but they are like, it's a religion to some people. It's incredible that he has this.
But that's a testament to just how amazing a player he's been, right, for the last decade. That's really amazing. But
well, let's go see him at the French Open. How about we should go?
All right, we'll talk offline and we'll plan.
I personally think he wants to play Tokyo 2020. So I don't think he's going to retire until then, because I feel like he still wants that single gold medal that he's never won. I think that's him, because he won in the doubles with Wawrinka, but he's never won a single
gold. It's the one thing that's missing from his collection.
It's literally the one thing that's missing.
I think you might be right.
So I have a feeling his body, if his body holds up,
he's going to play for Switzerland in Japan 2020, in Tokyo 2020.
Yeah, I can totally see it.
Wow, maybe we should plan for that.
Sure, Sue. Okay, I mean
Tokyo, you know. 2020.
I would go to that.
Me too. I love Tokyo. It's amazing. But you're right. That is the one thing that he has never gotten. And how many Olympics has he played in? He played in London.
I think he's played in like four.
Wow, that's like the worst. That's like the worst record of Federer ever.
Well, I mean, he lost to Murray one year.
That was in London.
And then in Rio, I think, did he play in Rio or was he injured?
I don't remember. Yeah.
I can't remember. I remember because that was also Murray against Del Potro in the final. I feel like he missed that one. And he probably played like Sydney and a couple other ones. But I'll have to fire up Google for that one.
Federer missed the Rio 2016 Olympics and the rest of that season, actually, so due to a knee injury. So he didn't play. Yeah,
that's right. Play Rio. Yeah. That was the year we went to the US Open to see him, and we did it.
We're so smart.
1 year, I remember we were at the Rogers Cup, and we got that news. And
yes,
we're like, damn it! God damn
it. We're like, no.
Do you want to talk about? I want to talk about, it, and then maybe we can move on from the Miami Open. I think the other story that I mentioned that I was really excited about, and I was kind of disappointed in how he lost his semi. It is in Stefanos Tsitsipas because I saw him at the Rogers Cup. I think you did.
Yeah,
too.
We were there together.
We were there together, and I saw him actually twice at the Rogers Cup because I went another day
without you.
And I have to say, without you, I'm sorry. I went with our other friend Amit, and I have to say, watching him play live, I just thought this guy is a future, like, slam champion. It's just the way he was on court, the way he played, his movement, his thinking ability on the court, I think he has a champion's mentality, and I kind of hope he sort of lives up to his potential in this year or the next.
I mean, his win over Federer, right?
Yes.
Was that at the Australian Open? Yeah, right? That was...
Quarterfinals, yes.
That was just an amazing moment in tennis, I felt, at least for me, because we'd seen him, I believe it was either the quarterfinal or the semifinal at Rogers. And I thought the same thing. I was like, this guy is going to be a Grand Slam champion. And then when he beat Federer, I was like, he is on schedule, you know? This young man is on schedule.
Yes. I actually thought he was going to win the tournament.
And I was like, okay, he's like ticking all the boxes. He's finally like beaten his idol, you know? And he looked really good doing it. Like he really made Federer not look great out there. And I was like, great, fantastic. And also I think his off tennis persona, off court persona is really, really lovely. Like I also follow him on Instagram. So, you know, and I see some of his Insta stories and a lot of his posts and, you know, he's a quirky guy, you know, he's really artistic, really creative. He's really into photography and making videos and, he has a really lovely sort of perspective about the world and he just seems like a really respectful young man and So, you know, and now he's in the top 10. So, you know, I feel like he's moving along the trajectory just as he should be, you know? And I think only things will get better as things go along. If he can manage his schedule a bit better, because I think in the last month or month and a half, I think he was just playing tennis nonstop and it kind of showed up a little bit in his results. He didn't go far in a couple of tournaments.
Yeah, I think a lot of the younger players, I think because they commit to tournaments ahead of time. And when they don't have that ranking, I think that's an issue. Not an issue, but I think that's why you see sort of the younger players when they're rising in the rankings, they're more committed to a lot more tournaments because they probably in the beginning don't expect to win or get to those finals maybe. And so they want to just like get as many ranking points as they can. So I feel like that could be solved for him, like no problem, but maybe he'll be like a team and he just likes to play constantly and then wear himself out by the end of the year.
I think
some players like to play week in, week out as well. Because they feel like they want to get the
matches. Yeah, I don't know if he's one of those guys. Because I think in one of his press conferences, I don't remember when it was, but he was just sort of like, I'm so tired. You know, he's like, I've been playing too much tennis. You know, I need a break. Like, my head's not in it, you know? That was really kind of refreshing. I was like, oh, he just admitted that he's been playing too much tennis and he wasn't focused out there, you know? Because he was so tired. And so I think he's one of those guys that he does need the break. He needs sort of the mental break in order to, sort of stay motivated. And so, I think that's sort of reflective in sort of the recent results he's had, that he was just playing too much. So I guess now, I don't know, he's seeded for Indian Wells, right?
Yeah, he's in the top 10. Well, for Miami too. Yeah, he's a top 10 player.
So we'll see. We'll see how he does.
Well, I mean, he was 14 at the beginning of the year, so I think he's seeded. Yeah. He's going to be seeded at everything from now on. So, okay, so let's segue a little bit into Indian Wells. Indian Wells, I watched a little bit. I watched the women's final, most of it, but I fell asleep. And not that it wasn't exciting, but it was really late here because I'm in London right now. And then I watched some of the Nadal-Khachanov match. And I saw something else as well, but I can't remember what it was. It's a fun tournament. I feel like there's a reason why they want to win it.
It's it's considered what a premier mandatory tournament, right?
Yeah, and then on the men's side, it's a Masters 1000. But I think, I don't know why, but I think because it has a prestige and a reputation. I think Indian Wells and Miami always compete for that. But those two tournaments, for some reason, have a little bit more prestige than some of the other ones that have the same ranking points for whatever reasons. So, I think the history of it or I don't know what it is, but it definitely, if you win Indian Wells, it's a marker, you know, and we had two young players win on both the men's and the women's, you know, the Dominic Thiem, a surprise winner,
very
in my
surprising.
Opinion. I didn't expect it. Because he's been sort of under the radar this whole year.
And everybody knows Thiem does not do particularly well on hard court.
No, but you know, he played really well in that quarter against Nadal at the US Open.
That's true.
And I think when I watched him play that, I just thought, oh, maybe he can play on hard.
It's not that he can't. He just hadn't been doing very well on that surface.
No, I think when I watched him against Nadal in that quarterfinal, I thought, well, this guy it's surprising he doesn't have the results on the board. So he's proved it this week. So who knows what's going to happen with him? Because I think he's kind of been the forgotten man in this whole generation next gen, you know, players coming up. Even though he got to a slam final last year, he's done pretty well. He's consistently in the top 10, but it just seems like he's kind of a forgotten man in that sort of conversation about, you know, is it going to be Zverev? Is it going to be Shapovalov?
Right.
Tsitsipas? All these sort of young players coming up, and I think team sort of gets forgotten.
He was sort of, he's been sort of lurking in the background, just plugging away, working hard.
Yeah.
You know, and then now that's sort of paid off in Indian Wells, which is great.
I mean, I give him a chance of maybe after Nadal and Djokovic winning the French.
Oh, yeah. He's definitely up there for me in terms of doing really well at the French. For sure.
Yeah. I mean, he got to the final last year, so he knows.
Well, that's his favorite surface, right? He has a special touch on the clay. So if Nadal can get healthy again in time for the French, then hopefully.
Yes. Which he always does somehow. I don't know how he does it. He miraculously recovers.
Well, he would be, if Nadal won the French Open this year, it would be his 12th.
Imagine. Can you imagine?
Can't 12? Imagine. Definitely. Yeah.
By God.
Definitely in the history books.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that, like, I mean, you know, Wawrinka, Djokovic, and Federer are the only three players to win it in that time span, I think. Since Nadal won his first.
That's insane.
So that's, isn't that insane? In the last 15 years, he's won it 12 times.
11.
Or, sorry, 11 times. 14 years, he's won it 11 times. I'm assuming he's going to win it this year as well. But that's
crazy.
Insane. Like
that
has to be one of the greatest sort of sporting achievements.
Absolutely. But this question of like whether he's going to win his 12th French Open, I mean, do you think that was one of the reasons why, I mean, other than the injury itself, I mean, of course, why Nadal pulled out of the semifinal with Federer at Indian Wells?
I think it was interesting. Like, you know, like the last couple of years, people have sort of, some people, have kind of criticized Federer for skipping the clay season because they think it's not fair that he's resting his body, you know, and all the other players are sort of beating themselves up on the surface. But I feel like Nadal has also done this, but in an unofficial way where he just takes injuries or maybe it's not a conscious thing, but, you know, there was like long periods last couple of years where he was out injured during some hardcore tournaments, you know, and he never played. He seems to never play the sort of indoor post-US Open tournaments.
Right, yeah.
And I think there is definitely that sense of, I need to preserve my body for the clay season because he knows that's his time. You know, I mean, he's obviously great on all the other surfaces. He's won all the four slams, but, you know, obviously the clay, he's the king of clay for a reason. And I think that's sort of why he dropped out of the match against Federer. He probably just takes a bit more care during the non-clay tournaments.
I think it was a lot of disappointment because I think everyone was looking forward to another, you know, at least I was looking forward to another Nadal Federer head to head. And
well, it hasn't happened in a while. We were thought that was going to happen at the Australian, and then Federer lost to Tsitsipas, and then, you know, and now this happened where they both won, but obviously Nadal couldn't go through with it. And it's kind of disappointing also for the fans, because everyone sort of knew or thought that if he lost that second set, he probably would have retired from the match. Yeah. And then we could have, Federer could have had a semifinal opponent instead of a walkover. So it's disappointing how that happened. But I mean, of course, when you're playing and you're in the moment and you're playing to win, and then you figure it out later, right? So I'm blaming Nadal for not, like, you know, for winning the match, because that's what he's supposed to do. But it's disappointing that Khachanov couldn't really expose the injury, because I watched that match and I thought, how are you losing this? Because you're playing an injured opponent here. You know, I think that will that match will haunt Karen for a while. So, and then on the women's side, it's very exciting because we're both Canadians. Yeah. It's Andreescu, and she's very exciting to watch. She's only 18. So good.
She's only 18, and she's come up through the Canadian developmental system in tennis. I mean, from what I've read, she was born in Canada, and then her family briefly moved back to Romania, where that was the first time she sort of picked up a tennis racket. And then the family ended up moving back to Canada and settled in Toronto and Mississauga, actually, where I grew up.
Me too, oh, girl.
And she, you know, sort of began her tennis career here. And she made history in Indian Wells too, because she's the first wild card to win Indian Wells ever. Yeah.
Wow.
So she actually had to qualify to get into the main draw. So she played 7 matches to qualify for the main draw. And then she played 7 matches in the actual tournament to win.
7 matches to qualify? That sounds like doesn't sound 7 right.
7 and 7, right?
Qualifying rounds are usually 3.
I don't think she got a bye or anything.
No, qualifying rounds are only 3 rounds. Then.
Right.
And that's still amazing. Oh yeah. She's incredible, you know, and that's, I mean, you know, and if you think about the players who've won Indian Wells, like really young, I think it's like Serena Williams, Monica Seles, and like all these like legends of the game have won it sort of early in their career as well. So that's amazing.
Yeah, she and everybody sort of, I mean, I love watching her because she has such a complete game. She she has almost every shot in the book, you know? She's got a baseline game.
Yeah,
she can come up to the net. Yeah. She has these lovely drop shots. She has these floating lobs that are really interesting. She can do a running cross court forehand straight to the line. She's got power, you know. she just keeps her opponents off balance, which is really exciting to watch.
I would say the only thing that's not exposed necessarily, but that I think will come a bit with her developing is her serve isn't the best.
To be fair, her first serve isn't great, but her second serve is really strong.
But I'm just saying, can you imagine when, like, can you, like, the world will be her oyster if she can get that first serve, she could sort of, I don't know what it is. It's like, it's just, it's slightly predictable and maybe just not as consistent as it should be. But I mean, if she's only 18, you know, like, I mean, we're being like super, super picky here. But I think if she gets that sort of rocking and like sort of firing, because now I think the thing that's going to be, the thing that's going to challenge her now is that now other players will be gunning for her because they know what she's about, and then they're going to fear her, and they're going to be more up for like trying to like beat her because they know she's one with Indian Wells. So now it's going to be interesting how she handles that as well. So we'll see what happens, but I feel like she can do it.
Yeah. I think she's smart enough to know that, you know, now she's made a name for herself. And so everybody's going to be really studying her game, you know, but I mean, I think the advantage to her game is that because she has such an arsenal of shots, different shots, that she never, you know, she never falls into a rhythm, right? Or she never lets her opponents fall into a rhythm. And so she has that element of surprise on her side. And I think that even if you study, you know, her game, you know, quite closely, I think you still can't rule out that element of surprise, that she could decide to just change it up from one shot to the next. And you can't predict that, you know?
Well, I mean, Kerber is such a great tactician and great defensive player, and she was frustrating her like crazy. And I was like, how are you doing this to someone like Kerber, who that's her bread and butter? It's like, and she was just, you know, she would do like these drop shots out of nowhere, and you know, she would do these like weird looping shots that will like that will just go on an angle, and I don't know how she did them. Like, there's shots I've never seen before, actually, from her. It's kind of amazing.
I'm really impressed, and I'm, you know, and the irony is that even though she won Indian Wells, she still has to qualify for Miami Open. I think.
Really? Did they give her a wild card?
Well, because I think they already gave out their wild cards, right? So she had to show up for qualies like basically 2 days after the final at Indian Wells. I think today's Wednesday, right? Yeah, I think she's supposed to be playing qualies today. So
I'm surprised they don't have these like a couple of wild cards sort of open.
Yeah, but she was ranked like what, 150 going into Indian Wells, and now she's coming out.
Well, she's in the top 30 now.
She's gonna be 24 or something
afterwards.
It's that's crazy, you know? It's crazy and amazing. And these are really, really fantastic times for Canadian tennis. On the men's side, Felix Auger-Aliassime. Yeah, he's been doing really, really well. Another young man from Canada. I believe he is also only 18 years old. Yes. And he made it all the way to the final in, I believe it was Rio. Was it Rio?
I think so.
He didn't win Rio, but then he rolled into Indian Wells. And he got to the quarters.
I want to say.
Yeah. And, yeah.
Oh, good for him.
And he defeated some top players. Top players. Of course, I can't remember who right now.
It was interesting to read, because I read a column in Sports Illustrated, John Wertheim. He has like a weekly column where like people ask, mm-hmm. like it's a mailbag. And the first question this week was, it was about, you know, will the Canadians finally get a Grand Slam champion soon? You know, because with Felix, with Andreescu, and of course with Dennis, we have all these like young players coming up. And John's theory is that it's a good thing that all three of them are playing now at the same time, because there isn't so much pressure on just one of them.
That's true. Yeah.
You know, spotlight isn't on just one. And then you still have Raonic, who's a viable, you know, contender, you know.
Yeah, he's still up there.
You know, still out there. He got to the semis at the Indian Wells, and he's done well this year. And he did well at the Australians. So he's still a viable contender. And Bouchard is sort of coming up again. I don't know how viable she is as a contender, but she's so there's less spotlight now on one Canadian as well. So it's exciting time for Canadian
tennis. Excited. I'm really excited for this year's Rogers Cup. It's the men's in Toronto this year, and the women in Montreal.
I thought it was the flip.
Oh, wait, sorry. Yes, women's last year. That's even better. Because I was actually hoping, I was actually like, I really want to see the women this year. So that actually worked out well.
I might have to go to a wedding in Montreal the weekend before it starts. I might just stay for a day.
Oh my gosh, that'd be amazing.
Especially Federer's playing, and then come back. But I don't know what's happening.
Well, keep me posted. I might join you. Yeah, that would be great.
Yes, come. I'll let you know how it goes. It's exciting. I want to see Osaka live.
And now I want to see Bianca Andreescu live, because she'll certainly be seated at that tournament.
And I want to see Sabalenka, and I want to see who's that player
Anna
who
Simova?
Beat her?
I want to see the young Amanda Anisimova from the United States.
She's another big story, I think, waiting to happen. I think with Osaka winning the Australia and the US Open, I think all these younger players are starting to believe,
We
can do it too.
Yeah. I think that's what's making women's tennis so exciting right now, is that there's so many contenders. There's so many players that could just, you know, really surprise us and win these tournaments. And and everybody is so competitive. And that's what's so amazing. And like, even in Indian Wells, like I think we felt the women's side, you know, a side of play was kind of more exciting than the men's, you know?
And it was interesting for me that I think there was a couple of years ago, there was a lot of talk about who's going to, you know, once Serena is out or she's not playing anymore, women's tennis is going to suffer. And we're saying that now about the men's side, like once the big three are gone, men's tennis is going to suffer. But there's always going to be a champion at the end of the tournament. There's always going to be new champions. And I think we overstate these things sometimes, because we've been so blessed with those four amazing champions. You know,
I think the game is evolving as well, right? Like just the way that the game is played is evolving, and you know, you're seeing different kinds of shots, you're seeing different rhythms, you know, you're just seeing different kinds of play. And I think that's sort of opening the door even more to, you know, other kinds of players and giving them legitimate shots at winning these tournaments. And so I think that just adds to the excitement, you know, the excitement of the game and the competitiveness of the game. So I'm feeling very optimistic. about where you know tennis is going, and in terms of the level of play. Not so sure about what's happening behind the scenes, but in terms of the level of play and like sort of what we're seeing from our young generation of players, I'm like very, very excited. Very excited about the future.
Yeah, we were talking offline about this, about what's happening behind the scenes. I actually don't know the ins and outs of what's happening with the ATP. And so I don't know if I have an opinion on that.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, there's been a lot of coverage in the news about how the current, I believe, ATP president, a gentleman named Chris Kermode, has been voted out by the Players Council, which is a body made up of pro player representatives that are either past and present. And
yes,
yeah, Djokovic is on that. And you know, there's been a lot of, I guess, controversy because it's been a baffling decision because from the outside, you know, Chris Kermode apparently in his 5 years has done amazing things for the tour and has really raised the profile of the sport and has been able to bring in equal prize money for women, you know, at major Grand Slams. And he's done a really, really good job apparently of, you know, sort of managing the different demands and expectations of both the tournaments and the players. But for whatever reason, and I don't know, I have no idea what's happened. He's been voted out despite his track record of doing what appears to be a very good job. So, I have no idea, but it seems to be getting a lot of coverage in the media. So I don't know. We'll have to see how it plays out. They still have yet to vote in a new person to replace Chris Kermode because he's going to, you know, sort of work until the end of this season. But there's been no talk about who's going to replace him. So I have no idea.
I mean, just in general, I find tennis, like that side of things, there's always like different interests, and it's not it always just feels like it's hanging on by a thread somehow. You know, like well, because I feel like the players don't really, because it's not, there's no union, obviously. They're not a team. Everyone is like
independent contractor.
Yeah, is like their independent contractor. Yeah. So to me, it's obviously it works, but to me, it's amazing that it's all been held together for as long as it has been. And it feels like the ATP Players Council, especially with someone like Djokovic, who's so such a big name, they probably have a bit more sway at the moment. You know,
it's possible,
but I don't know the mechanics of it or I'm sort of like left with a shrug. You know, as long as the tournament gets staged and there's equal prize money and things like that. I don't know if I can get that invested, but I've seen a lot of stories about it. I just don't know what's happening. It's one of those aspects of the game. I'm like,
I guess from our perspective,
they introduce encore coaching at the slams, if they introduce encore coaching. I hate encore coaching.
During the final at Indian Wells, Bianca Andreescu, she called down her coach, and she it was very enlightening to hear the conversation between the two, because it really showed her grit and determination, because she, you know, I think she, it was at a point in the match where she was extremely tired, very exhausted. And yet, you know, and I think she told her coach her feet were burning, And she said, but I want this so bad. And that was really kind of like, wow, this girl is amazing, you know?
Yeah, it's interesting, but you don't, I don't want
her. You don't want to hear that conversation. You don't even want her to have it.
No, I don't want her to have it. What I love about tennis is that each player is out there on their own and they figure it out. And I hate on-court coaching. I think coaching from the stands as well should be banned also, or more forced.
We had this conversation before.
Because I don't think we should move towards letting coaching happen. I think it's a bad move.
Well, it's a little, I mean, I would agree with you. I don't like the idea of on-court coaching, especially now since it's only on the women's side, which I find really kind of, it implies something.
It looks uncomfortable.
About female players that I'm not particularly happy about. You know, and while the Bianca Andreescu thing was, you know, was really entertaining and it gave me an insight into her character as a player, you know, you're right. It didn't add anything for me. I think perhaps even without her having to talk with the coach, she probably would have went out there anyway and like won the next three games, which is exactly what she did. I'm a traditionalist like you. I like the fact that tennis really is one of the sort of true individual sports. One of the really special things about tennis is that it is a person to person, you know, you got to figure it out, and really is, you know, it's a game that really defines a champion. Right? A champion is someone who figures it out despite all the odds and comes out with the win.
Yes.
You know? On-court coaching, no.
No, it's interesting to me how I think we as a society, I don't want to get too deep on you here because it's past midnight where I am right now, but I think there's been a shift in society, and I don't know if it's because, I don't know, I mean, do we have to blame everything on social media?
But yes, we do.
You know, I remember 2006 when Sharapova won the US Open, and I think she beat Hanan in the final. And there was this mad outcry because her dad, who was her coach at the time, signaled to her to eat a banana. At a point in the match. And it wasn't like move in or like, you know, switch up your serve, or it wasn't a hand movement. It was literally him pointing to her to eat a banana. And there was this massive outcry. And I just thought, and that was, 2006, so 13 years ago. And I just thought, how did we change in society in just over a decade from people getting outraged over a signal to eat a banana to like everyone coaching on the sidelines and people ignoring it? Like, to me, it's like, how did that happen in just like 13 years? It's insane to me, you know, and this is why I'm
really. I think you make a really, really good point. And, and you have, you know, you have the benefit of, you know, having been such a tennis fan for so long that you have this sort of history, right, to draw on. Because I didn't know that. So, I mean, that really does beg the question, like, what happened over the last 10 years to sort of allow these sort of changes to occur, you know, within the sport of tennis? And, you know, some people might argue, like, I'm going to play devil's advocate here. Like, some people might argue that, well, you know, tennis has to evolve like anything else, right?
Okay, but why does it have to evolve into this? Yeah. I understand about the change of the scores. You know, you want to make it quicker. You want to make it more exciting. All this stuff. Like, but if you want it to evolve... Yeah, okay, make the matches shorter, put the shot clock, you know, remove the let rule, which is a stupid rule. Things like that, but I don't understand how allowing coaching, which is a thing that will make the game better, because basically you'll be watching players depend on the coaches and then think, you know, they're not thinking on their own out there. And I think, you know, it's kind of like, I know this is a weird analogy, but it's like when they wanted to not show all of the awards at the Oscars this year on TV. And it was like, it's like you're trying to get this other group of people to like a thing and you're ignoring the group of people who already love it.
Yeah.
And you're actually just like giving them a finger, you know, you're saying to them, you know, we don't care about what you love about this thing because we're chasing this other thing. And I feel like that's what's happening here, you know, and, you know.
Wow. That was very profound.
I don't know. I managed to get in a dig against the Oscars in this. It went somewhere. I don't know.
Well, on that note, should we wrap it up? Yeah.
I think so. I think, yeah.
And we're all caught up. So this is sort of the, this weekend, I think, is the start of the Miami Open at its brand new facility, because I think when we went to the Miami Open, it was still the Key Biscayne facility, which, to be fair, was quite and so I'm looking at all the pictures now of you know, the new facility, and wow. So
it's central Miami, and like going to Key Biscayne, it felt like, you know, we were trying to find the ring and we're going to Mordor, you know.
It was far it was far,
and then we parked bus, and then we had to take
a
bus.
Bless them, they had everything, you know, organized to a T, and, you know, it was very smoothly run, but wow, we really were in the bushes somewhere out there. So
Liv Tyler showed up all of a sudden. I'm like, what's happening? No.
So maybe one day we'll have to get to the new Miami Open facility and see what that's like.
Yes. I'm sometimes in Miami for work, so maybe next time I'm there we could go.
Well, yeah.
So I think we should definitely reconvene at the end of the Miami Open. So
yeah, let's
look
do
forward
that.
To that. And
okay. Well, thanks everyone for listening. Follow us on Twitter at Two Sets Podcast, TWO Sets Podcast, and find us on iTunes and Spotify and leave us a review. Thanks so much for listening. Bye.
Bye.